Today on Maine Calling, winter birding in Maine. Sure, birders love to flock to Maine for the spring and winter migration seasons, but they are also happy campers right now, in winter. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, it is easier to spot birds without leaves on the trees. And two, there are those snowbirds who fly from the Arctic south to Maine every winter. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we check in with birding experts about exciting birds to look for right now. We'll find out if there have been any rare bird sightings in Maine recently. We'll also learn the latest on the Maine Bird Atlas, and we will get tips on photographing birds in your backyard or elsewhere. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Highland Green, an active 55-plus lifestyle community with a 230-acre nature preserve, highlandgreenlifestyle.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Birds are tough. So even though we've had some bitter cold weather this year, there are plenty of species who have been sticking out the season in Maine, and even some for whom this is considered south. We're going to learn how to see and hear some of those birds and maybe photograph them. And we're going to learn about the newly completed Maine Bird Atlas. My guest today, Dr. Adrian Leppold, who is a wildlife biologist who has served as the project director for the Maine Bird Atlas, and Doug Hitchcox, staff naturalist for Maine Audubon. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you seen any interesting birds out there lately? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And a note here, whenever we talk about birds on Maine Calling, there are a lot of calls and emails, so don't wait until the end to call. If you have a good question for our experts, call or email in early. Well, welcome back to both of you. Doug, I'll start with you. You know, every once in a while, some really exciting rare species shows up in Maine, and it sort of transcends just the bird world. Everybody's buzzing about it. Is anything like that going on right now in Maine?
Yeah, not quite to the level that folks might remember with the Steller Sea Eagle that really made all the headlines a few years ago. But it's been an exciting year for birders, especially with some of the what we would call eruptive species. So
eruptive species.
Yeah, eruptive, spelled with an I. So it's like when birds, you can think of it as they need to go outside of their normal range, typically in search of food. So for these finches that lots of birders are appreciating this winter, it's because of really bad either cone or fruit crops further north. So they're coming south and dazzling birders all across the state.
So we're seeing finches that we don't usually see. Are these birds we don't usually see ever, or we don't usually see in the winter?
When they come down, it's typically in the winter. Some of these do nest in like northern Maine. So evening grosbeaks are a great example of a species that all over the state right now, people are reporting large flocks descending on their feeders. It's a large, you know, people say they often look like, you know, oversized goldfinches. They're large yellow finches, technically. And yeah, they're just down in big numbers right now, along with things like red poles. Yeah, that's really entertaining folks.
And when you say down, are they all over Maine, or are they just in parts of Maine?
Yeah, all over the state. Even down here, I'm down in Cumberland County, but hearing reports, you know, all along the coast, even up into the Western Mountains, they're everywhere.
All right. Adrian, anything that you've spotted recently that you're excited about?
Honestly, the evening grosbeaks are the highlight. that was kind of on the top of my list as well, as Doug mentioned. And it's especially nice to see that species. That's a species that's been in really, really steep decline. It's one of our most threatened boreal specialists. And it also, so you know, the numbers back in the 70s and 80s were in the thousands. And so people delight now when we get like the tens or the hundreds even. And so it's nice to see that. And it's a species that's tied really closely to spruce budworm and other, you know, forest insects that go through these cyclical, oh my gosh, that's a hard word, cyclical cycles. They really kind of boom and bust, and their population has been dependent on that. So it's a good indicator species of, you know, things that and changes in forestry management and insect suppression can have impacts. And so it's a species we're watching closely from the science side of things as well, and monitoring those declines.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit, Doug, about this winter. And today it's mild, but we've had some really, really cold nights. It's been colder than it has been in recent years. How are birds affected by that?
In general, the cold isn't as much of an issue for birds. It tends to all be about food availability. So it's kind of fun to watch, especially like I commute through Westbrook a lot, and it's really entertaining to kind of check in on like the little open patches of water and see how, especially ducks, just congregate in those. And especially some of like the uncommon species that you can see mixed in. I've enjoyed picking out northern pintails hanging out with the mallards, which would want to be out in salt marshes or closer along the coast. But following the Penobscot down, it's amazing to me how frozen in it is this winter. I lead a bird walk at Gilsland Farm, Maine Audubon's headquarters in Falmouth, every Thursday. And for the last, it's at least 3 weeks now, maybe we're going on four, the entire river right there, which does, it's very brackish. It dumps right into the ocean right around the corner. Very tidally influenced. It should be breaking up, with every tide cycle. It is completely frozen in, and our counts on those walks are actually quite low because of kind of the missing out on that habitat.
Now, when you say that the counts are low, does that make you worried? Does that make you worried that the birds are not getting enough food, or do you think they're just finding it elsewhere?
They're finding it elsewhere. So that's a huge bias towards where we're doing the walk. If we could just, I'm sure downriver a little bit, right into Casco Bay, there's probably just as many ducks as ever. Some birds will adjust that, if it's too cold, the snow's too deep, we will see, movements further south. I think there's definitely some influences like that. But it's fun to think birds have been, surviving millions of years, and seen quite the temperature fluctuations throughout it. So they'll adapt.
Well, Adrian, I understand one of the reasons it's great to go bird watching in the wintertime is just because it's easier to see them. Trees don't have leaves, so you know you can spot things more easily, but also because there are birds that fly south to Maine in the winter. What are some of the birds that people might find this time of year that they won't find any other time of year?
Well, yeah, I completely agree. And to your point, Jen, I think, you know, winter's a great time to even get into birding. So people who are interested in birds, but it kind of seems overwhelming, you know, you have these field guides and these books that are hundreds of pages long, and you flip through it and you're just like overwhelmed immediately. And how am I ever going to learn it? Winter is a great time to learn. It's when I got started, the options especially, you know, are a lot less as far as an entire field guide goes. And to, as we were mentioning earlier, a lot of the winter finches, those eruptive species that come down that Doug already mentioned, are great, you know, our grosbeaks and things like snow buntings that we don't really have in the breeding season. But a lot of other species that are really exciting and kind of reaching their southern, that we are their southern wintering grounds, are some of our shorebirds and waterfowl. So things like the harlequin duck or purple sandpipers, and so going in, you know, onto the coastal areas and looking into that open water along shore, those are great birding opportunities in the winter time. And then we can also get, you know, it's unpredictable, and that's what makes it exciting. We can get those southern pushes of movements of northern boreal owls and raptors. So, you know, snowy owls are always a big highlight. Sometimes we've had great grays or northern hawk owls grace Maine during the winter. And so those are all always things to keep eyes out for this time of year.
Adrian, what are your tips for finding? I'm just thinking about the harlequin duck because it's so pretty. How do I find one?
Check eBird. that's the, I mean, nowadays with all this active reporting, eBird managed through Cornell Lab of Ornithology online, you can go on and just type in any species and kind of get updates. You can sign up for bird alerts, basically. So interesting species, and it'll just drop you information in your email inbox with the location and the date and the time. That's the easiest and best way to kind of stay up on a day-to-day changes of where to go to find birds. But I will throw a plug in for the Atlas. That will be another great resource, as we have spent.
Well, I was going to ask you about that next. Yeah. So, but before I ask you about that, I just want to ask Doug if there's anything you want to add to what Adrian said about, you know, someone's listening right now. They're like, okay, weekend's coming up. I'm going somewhere to look for birds. Where do you send them?
Yeah, eBird is the best resource. I'll give the plug. There's also some very active Facebook pages in Maine, one called Maine Birds, which I love watching mostly to bird vicariously and see like what people are seeing in their backyards, or if they're going out in the field, what's getting reported. That can be a really fun way to just, you know, you also get some absolutely stunning photos. There's some very accomplished photographers in that group as well.
All right. So, Adrian, I want to talk to you about the Maine Bird Atlas. I know that we've talked about this on Maine Calling before, but it's been a while. So for those people who are new to Maine Calling or don't know about the Maine Bird Atlas, tell us about this project. This was a ginormous project, right? Lots of people involved, lots of years. When did it start? And where are you now?
Well, it technically started about halfway through 2016 was when we prompted the proposal to fund and pull together this project. It was a 5-year effort primarily. So data collection occurred from 2018 through 2022, and we extended it to March of 23 just to get one more complete winter survey season. And for those not familiar, it was an effort to document the abundance and distribution of all of Maine's breeding and wintering birds all over the state. Over 6,500 individuals, people contributed to this project, accumulating nearly 2 million records. We documented 332 species total in the state. And it really served as a vital signs check for Maine's birds. Where are they? How are they doing? What species are improving? What species are showing signs of stress? The whole project's kind of been dormant and quiet the last couple years, as our editorial team, Doug and I are both part of, have been working behind the scenes to kind of take those 2 million observations that people contributed to this project and transform those sightings into meaningful data and insights into Maine birds. So we have been working quietly but hard over the last couple of years, and we completed the publication. All of the results have been summarized. There's actually a lot more that can be done with the data, but we've put together a 750-page book. We took it to the publisher on December 30th of 2025, and folks can expect books in hand by this fall. And I'll just, our hope, I guess, is we'd love to do a whole episode just talking about, you know, what we've learned from this project. So maybe later this this year, we can get into that. I will be giving our first big outreach presentation for Kennebec Land Trust on March 12th. So if you're interested to learn more sooner than later, mark your calendars for that.
Congratulations. I can't imagine how that's going to feel to have the first book in your hand. Well, I will ask you now, and probably next fall as well, Adrian, and I'll ask you the same thing right now, Doug. You know, both of you came into this project with a whole lot of knowledge about birds, but I'm wondering if anything surprised you, Adrian. Is there anything that you just never expected, or the scale of which you didn't expect?
I definitely, this was a project from the outset that I, one of my favorite quotes by Nelson Mandela is, it always feels impossible or seems impossible until it's done. And I carried that quote through this entire project because it was all like the scale of it was always sort of daunting and overwhelming. But I think, you know, just the overwhelming success that we had and the engagement with over 6,500 people for contributing to this project was just phenomenal. I think one of the big takeaways for me, and I'll be anxious to hear what Doug wants to share as well, was it definitely highlighted the declines in bird numbers and in diversity and distribution are very real. And it highlighted some areas of the state that we were not expecting, particularly down east. That was a big takeaway for me. And the other thing that I think kind of connecting to this show that people may not realize and was a really neat product of this, you know, we got a species count. We documented 232 species of birds spend winters from December through March in the state. Actually, more species occur in the state during the winter than they do during the breeding season. And so that's another kind of, I think, fun surprise that ties to this show in particular.
Doug, what was surprising to you when you started going through the data and figuring out how to talk about it?
I will say, before going through the data, during the data collection, I have a whole new appreciation for how large the state is. The surveys we were doing up in kind of the northwestern portion of the state, Piscataquis County, and just trying to access those areas was, I learned a lot of skills throughout this. I'll echo what Adrian said. You know, there's some interesting, the declines are the scary thing. And one of the fascinating things to me was especially some of the species that we, I'd say we generally knew what was going on, or, you know, we have this idea of, okay, these birds are expanding their range northward. But when you actually see the data, and an important piece of this was comparing it to an atlas effort that was done back in the 70s to 80s. So having these snapshots in time and being able to compare from that original atlas to this one and see those changes over time. Again, it's some of the species that, like, I would have thought, like, northern mockingbird is a species that just seems to be expanding with suburban sprawl. They are just all over the place. They've actually retreated on the edges from the first atlas. And these are going to be some of the fun questions that, you know, I hope there's a grad student out there or someone who can really kind of dive in a bit more and see, like, what's changing.
All right. So if there's a grad student out there looking for a PhD project, you've got some ideas, Doug?
Oh, yes. And as Adrian said, we have millions of data points for them to go through.
Well, we are talking about birding in Maine. What are your questions? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Are you a bird lover? Do you have questions about bird watching? Joining me today, Doug Hitchcock, staff naturalist with Maine Audubon, and Adrian Leppold, wildlife biologist who recently helped complete the Maine Bird Atlas. Helped complete is actually an understatement. She was in charge of the whole project. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about birds, bird conservation, bird watching? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. So many good questions coming in. First, though, I want to talk to my colleague, Brian Bichard. Brian is a videographer, photographer, editor, and producer, and creative service director for Maine Public. Hi, Brian, and I understand you are calling me from the field today.
Hi, Jen. Yes, I'm actually on assignment as we speak. I am at the Wells Reserve at Laudholme, a beautiful spot down here in southern Maine. And I'm working on a Borealis story, which is one of our TV shows that we air on Maine Public Television. And we're doing, I'm in here with a group doing a cottontail rabbit study. So it's really fun.
Oh, have you been able to capture any video of cottontail rabbits? I know they're kind of sneaky.
Well, yeah, I know this is a birding show, but yeah, we're putting up camera traps actually today, which are cameras that are triggered by motion, kind of like a trail cam. So we've got a bunch of those on the property, and we're hoping to get some video and photos that way. They're very nocturnal, these rabbits, so we're trying to do our best to get what we can and not disturb the wildlife while we're in there too. So,
okay, Brian. Well, I understand. Well, I am a big fan of your Instagram feed and the beautiful bird pics you get, but I understand it was Borealis that spiked your interest in bird photography.
It kind of was. I mean, I've always been a photographer. I've enjoyed the hobby. I shoot my kids' sporting events and family events and things like that. So I've always had a camera. Is going back to high school days, and always enjoyed the hobby, but never really got into anything outdoorsy, especially with birds, until we started doing some wildlife stories on the Borealis program. And that did. It kind of got me thinking, oh, hey, what could I point my camera at out here in the woods or out here at the beach? And it took was a couple outings, and I was hooked on it, especially the birds. And I think it's because there's so many birds and such a variety of them out there that it makes for a great canvas for a photographer. And there's so many options that it's just an endless thing when you go out. You can't really run out of them.
Well, your photos are simply stunning. I think my favorite of recent weeks is the one of the bluebird in flight. He looks so determined. But I want to ask you, what kind of tips can you give those of us? I mean, obviously, they're not born with, most of us aren't born with your eye, but what kind of tips would you give people to get good photos of birds that don't just look like a blurry image from far away?
Well, great question, and thank you for the kind words. But I will tell you, I still get blurry images, so it's an ongoing process for every photographer out there. It's a challenge. I mean, you gotta. I don't want to turn this into a photography lesson, but you know, you gotta mind your shutter speed and have a steady hand or use a tripod. And a lot of it comes with practice. You know, I go out as often as I can, not as often as I'd like, but as often as I can. And I will even sometimes practice on things like moving traffic or my kids or pets or things like that. Anything that's moving fast, you can always just practice on that. If there aren't a lot of birds around or other wildlife that you're really focused on, you can just use other things in your day-to-day life to kind of hone your skills, so to speak. But I think the biggest thing for birds, especially birds in flight or any animal that's moving, you got to have that shutter speed cranked up. That will help freeze the action. Of course, you can get more artistic and slow the shutter speed down and get some motion blur in there, but that's a whole different story. When you're just starting out or you're kind of learning the craft, get that shutter speed up and be steady, or get it on a tripod, and that will help increase your hit rate.
Well, Brian, you know, as you were talking about the story that you're working on right now with the cottontail rabbits, being very careful about your environment and not to disturb the rabbits, I'm sure you're the same way about the birds. What are your tips for how to get that picture without disturbing habitat?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is a touchy subject. I mean, a lot of wildlife photographers – You know, there are wildlife photographers out there that have crossed the line for sure, can give the rest of us a bad name sometimes. I always go by the National Audubon has a field guide or guidelines for photographers. I go by that because I figure they know best. So I would direct people to go there and kind of read down their guidelines. It's very helpful. I use very long lenses, a 600 millimeter. I have an extender for that lens that will make it reach out to, I think, 800 something millimeters. And I rely on that to allow me to keep my distance. I also use a camera that has very high megapixel count, so that when I get it in the computer and I'm doing some editing to it, I can crop it in. So you don't always have to be right on top of the wildlife. And in fact, most of the times you shouldn't be. So using a long lens, and then cropping, and then realizing that nothing's worth a photo disturbing an animal, causing it to be stressed or worse, causing it to get into a situation that might lead to its death, of course, would be awful. So you never want to do any of that. There's no picture that's ever worth that. So just, I would say, you know, keep your distance. I always, you know, go by the football field length. Like if I'm 100 yards away from most things, I feel pretty good about that. And again, look for signs in the wildlife, the bird that you're photographing. If it's staring you down, if it looks uncomfortable, if it looks angry, you should back off and just let it be. And certainly if you're getting close enough where you're flushing the bird, that's not good either. So yeah, I mean, just use common sense and be respectful is what I would say.
Okay, so I have to ask you, what's your favorite get? What's the favorite photo you've gotten?
Oh, you know, I mean, I haven't been doing this that long. I have some great snowy owl photos that are in flight. Again, the snowy owl thing is a very touchy subject, so I don't want to belabor that. But I did go down. There were a few sightings this winter. There have been. I went down twice, and then I got a couple of photos, and I kind of ended my search, you know, for that photo. And I did come away with some good ones, and they were at a respectful distance. So that was one of my more recent ones that kind of got me excited just because that's such a magnificent bird. But I'll tell you, my heart is in the warblers, the small songbirds that migrate through here every spring. There's so many of them. Those are my favorite to photograph. They're the most challenging. They never sit still for 2 seconds. Just finding them in your long telephoto lens is a challenge in itself, let alone framing it well, having a nice background, and all the things that go along with making a good photograph. So those are my favorite. I did get a chestnut sided warbler and a blackburnian warbler last spring. Those are my two favorite gets from last year. And I've had a few near misses with a Cape May warbler, and I'm learning all these as we go. I'm becoming a bit of a birder with this new hobby of mine, so it's fun. It's really great. And but I'll tell you, anything is fun. The bluebirds I get in my backyard are a thrill too. So it doesn't really matter the species to me. I'm more just happy to make an awesome photograph and really showcase any species of bird and make it look as cool as I can make it and just enjoy the company of the birds that I'm around. That's really the most fun for me.
Well, Brian, before we let you go, I want to ask you to tell everybody what your Instagram handle is so that other people can see your bird photos.
Okay, I am not a social media pro. So if you like bird photos, please go to Brian with an I, Brian dot Bechard, Bechard dot 207. That's my Instagram handle. I have just recently started putting stuff up there, but I'll continue to put things there. And every now and then I'll throw a video up too, because that's kind of my real background with cameras. So every now and then I'll turn my camera into video mode and take a little bit of video too, which is always fun.
Well, thanks for calling in from the field, Brian, and keep posting. I'm loving those pictures.
I will, Jen. Thank you. And I'll see you soon, hopefully.
See you soon. Brian Bechard is a videographer, editor, producer here at Maine Public. Primary photographer for Borealis, our TV series. Doug, before we go to calls, though, I want to follow up on something Brian said. I've seen his spectacular pictures of snowy owls. I'm sure it makes you happy to hear that he stays 100 yards away from them. You are concerned about this, about the fact that people love snowy owls so much.
Yeah, I'll acknowledge it is a absolutely, you know, one of the most charismatic species out there. You know, many thanks to Harry Potter for popularizing the snowy owl so much. It can be a life-changing bird for folks. I've taken dozens, if not hundreds, of people out to see them now, and you know, I've literally seen people go to tears getting to see, you know, these Arctic visitors. And as has been kind of alluded to, like, owls tend to bring out some of the worst behavior in especially photographers. But they often, you know, they sit still, they think that they're camouflaged. It's the ways that they are, you know, naturally reacting. So oftentimes people, you know, approach much closer than they should. Unfortunately, people also intentionally flush them to get those flight photos. So these are, you know, probably the less than 1% of folks out there. But because these owls do attract bad behavior, that's where we tend to have a lot more, ethical discussions about them and just trying to make sure that people know how they should be acting. I will say every bird is different. One of the key things I always look for is when you're altering the bird's behavior. So 1,000 yards sounds great to me. But as soon as it's, you know, paying attention to you, if it's looked at you, you know, think about, it's fun to think owls have amazing eyesight, better hearing. They are much more tuned in. You know, we might think it's far away, but as soon as you're affecting that bird's behavior, that's a sign that you should be backing up, not when it's getting, you know, to the point of even, you know, potentially flushing it.
All right. Well, thanks for that. Joining us now is Nick Lund. He's also with Maine Audubon. He's the Advocacy and Outreach Manager. And Nick, I understand you have channeled your love of birds into a new children's book. Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. Hello, Jennifer. Hi, Doug. How's it going? I have a can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a new book coming out on March 3rd called A World Without Birds. It's a follow-up to another book by a gentleman named Mark Kurlansky who wrote A World Without Fish. And it's all about talking to middle grade readers, so teenagers, about bird conservation around the world. It's great. You know, it's a hard topic. How do you talk to kids or teenagers these days about environmental issues without getting too heavy or too dire? And the approach we've taken is to be frank about the problems that, you know, humans have caused around the world, but also talk about all the great work going on. You know, for every bird that is threatened, there are other birds being helped by people and countries and states putting resources into protecting birds. So there's as much to celebrate as there is to, you know, to warn about. And that's what this book, World Without Birds, gets into.
All right. So I understand it's about the whole world, but does it also relate to Maine birds and conservation efforts here in Maine?
Absolutely. You know, Maine has really been a vanguard of some types of avian conservation. I think one specifically is islands, right? So seabird islands all around the world. They have all these birds that nest there that don't really have defenses from predators. You know, there are no, you know, rodents or predators typically on these islands, but humans have introduced a lot of them around the world. And so seabird islands have been decimated around the world. It's a big problem. But Maine has been leading the charge. So our beloved Atlantic puffin was extirpated from the state of Maine around the turn of the century, the 20th century. It was no longer breeding here in part because of introduced rodents and, you know, people collecting their eggs and other things. But in the 1970s, the National Audubon Society and Maine Audubon and others worked together to bring them back. So we got rodents off the islands. We protected them from hunting and from collecting, and we lured them back using these sort of innovative decoy technologies and other sources that were extremely successful and have been used now in other islands all around the world. So Maine's a real sort of leader.
Wow, Nick, that's a great story. Nick Lund's new book is called World Without Birds. It is coming out March 3rd. Thanks for calling in, Nick. Let's see here. We'll start our calls coming in. We'll go to Elizabeth calling in from Parsonsfield Ward. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for listening and sharing as you do. I might lose you. I'm off grid and undependable here in the woods. Interesting tidbit I wanted to share. Since February 5th, bluebirds here at the cabin at the feeding station every day, they seem to come with the red-bellied woodpecker and go with him. They're not here all day long like the other birds. They have also been spotted about 12 miles away on Wiggins Mountain. And the first week in February, my great-grandson also saw one in Michigan. And of course, because he's a kid, no one would believe him. I have them at the cabin here through November, but never after deep snowfall, probably because of food.
So Elizabeth, you want to know from our experts if seeing bluebirds this time of year is usual?
Yeah, and has anybody else?
Okay. I have had bluebirds all winter as well. Doug?
Yeah, this is definitely the trend we're seeing right now. And you don't have to go too far back in time for bluebirds to be a rare sighting in Maine. One chart that I always like to look at is the Christmas bird count results for Maine. Those are counts that go on typically around Christmas. The idea is you have birders going out in all these predetermined circles trying to count all the birds that are there. And then we can add those up and then really see these changes over time. And if you go back to, it was around the mid-90s that some of the first bluebirds were like consistently being seen, but really, you know, single-digit numbers. And then it was only a decade later that it started getting into the double digits. And it's the curve is almost amazing, or unbelievable, I should say, where 2020, the winter of 23, I think into 24, was the first year that over 1,000 bluebirds were counted in Maine during the Christmas count. And the trend we're seeing is it's from the southern part of the state expanding northward. So this is a trend we see consistent with climate change. It's also, I think, you know, it's such a dramatic shift that I bet there's a bunch of factors playing into this. There are more people with feeding stations, especially mealworms. But I'll again make the plug, you know, we have this really cool map now for the Maine Bird Atlas. Since we mapped out where all the wintering birds are in the early season, the late season. So I'll, you know, later this year when it comes out, folks will be able to see it's the almost the entire southern half of the state we had records of eastern bluebirds for the Maine Bird Atlas.
Wonderful. What would you like to add to that, Adrian, about bluebirds? I mean, everybody loves bluebirds.
Oh, it is, but to Doug's point, it's such a common question that we get because, you know, and as he said, just a couple of decades ago, it was a rare sighting, but they have actually become fairly regular winter visitors and supported for all the reasons that he mentioned. So, yeah.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call. If you have a question, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We're talking about birds on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about winter birding in Maine. Our guest, wildlife biologist Adrian Leppold, who is the person in charge of the Maine Bird Atlas, and naturalist Doug Hitchcox with Maine Audubon. Share your comments and questions. Send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or call us at 1-800-399-3566. So many good questions coming in. I'll try to zip through some quick ones. This is from Susie. I've had a lot of bluebirds, chickadees, titmice, finches, sparrows, and other small birds at my feeders all winter. Only one pair of cardinals and one or two mourning doves, which I know usually mate for life. So it makes me sad to see one alone. I used to have a lot of mourning doves and miss them. Are they still considered common in Maine? Adrian.
Yeah, that's a great question. I love, you know, that it's maybe an underappreciated bird. Not, you know, a lot of people aren't talking about mourning doves anymore. It's a species that I think is still fairly stable in the state. And especially as we're sort of starting to bridge the gap from winter to spring, that can be a species that starts nesting fairly early. And I've been noticing it even in the cardinals in my own yard, that the pairs are starting to get a little bit more territorial. So where there might be a lot more communality happening at feeders in the densest part of the winter, I think territories are starting to get established. And so this may be why people are seeing fewer of certain species coming right to their feeders, because they're starting to kind of establish those breeding boundaries a little bit. But from our results thus far, mourning doves, I believe, are fairly stable. But
oh, good. So they're stable. They're just somebody else is in her yard and it's keeping the mourning doves away. An email here from Carl. A handful of years ago, tall cranes, I believe sandhill cranes, began showing up at a particular farm high on a hill in New Gloucester. The owner did nothing to attract them. They consistently return now for a period of time. Are sandhill cranes arriving elsewhere in Maine? Which of you wants to take this one?
We're both nodding along. Go for it, Doug.
I can real quick. The nesting in Maine started around 2000. It's this very interesting satellite population that has really took off in the Belgrade Lakes area. Messalonskee Lake is kind of the famous spot for them. But yeah, they have spread. New Gloucester is a well-known site to see them. If folks know the right off of 95, the gray exit, there's a pair that's been hanging out in the agricultural fields there the last few years, really until the corn grows too high that you can't see them anymore. But it's a species that is new to the Atlas. Again, seeing the change between the first and second Atlas is one of the coolest outcomes to me. And yeah, they're a species that's doing well and now expanding. Again, it started in Maine in 2000, and they're now nesting into other states in New England.
All right, we'll go to Carol, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Carol, go ahead.
Hi there, thank you. A little bit different perspective on birds. I happen to be blind and visually impaired, and I wondered about what might be available for me as far as, because I can't see them, but I can hear them. Certainly my hearing is still pretty good. So I wondered what might be available through the Maine Audubon or otherwise in expanding that, because there are a number of folks like myself that their eyesight is not as good. So, or might be, you know, just the hearing part of the sound, the calls, et cetera.
So Carol, that's such a great question. And I know that Cornell University has a big, archive of bird calls and I don't know, do either of you have a recommendation for something that's really sort of user friendly to be able to identify birds from calls?
So there are. I'll start with the larger answer. So a lot of folks know Merlin is a great app that can help identify birds that you're hearing. I'll quickly acknowledge I don't know about accessibility features within that app. I do want to make a plug. We have done work with the Iris Network before, would love to be doing more. I'll encourage you to reach out. But also there's a group called Access Birding, Birdability is who I'm thinking of. And they're actually launching, last year was the first year, but they're doing a blind birder birdathon this spring. I think it's May 3rd and 4th, and are putting together, there's a bunch of resources they have for folks to both get involved in that event and also, you know, learn some of the birds that are around. So
that's so neat, Doug. You said it's in May. Where is that?
I think anywhere that people want to get involved.
Oh, wow.
You can do it anywhere.
Carol, so there you go. Some great tips.
Carol, if you want to form a team, let's go see if we can beat the blind birder birdathon record.
That sounds great. Carol, thanks so much for calling with your important question. Let's see here. We'll go to Jamie, also calling from Portland. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Hey, just a basic question about bird feeders. We're in Portland here, and I've helped my mom up in Hamden in her development to keep a bird feeder going, but a little hesitant to putting one out, and just a basic, you're going to get some critters that come along with a bird feeder, I guess, but just the basics for putting it out, and is there any seasonality? Are you creating any dependence too, having one out, feeding wildlife, so to speak? So just general comments about bird feeders.
Okay. Thanks. Well, Doug, I have a feeling they're not terrible because you have them up at Audubon, right?
Yeah. I think 2 points to make, like birds, bird feeders are a great way to see birds, to get them to come closer to you. But we know birds never become fully dependent on them. They just supplement their diet a little bit with what we put out. The bigger thing I would say is if you are going to start feeding birds, there's a certain degree of responsibility that comes with it. And just knowing that bird feeders can be, a place that birds are congregating, disease can spread at them. If you're going to be putting a bird feeder up, you need to also assume the responsibility of keeping it clean. I often joke that, you shouldn't look at it and think like that's gross, not necessarily that you'd want to eat off of it. But if you're seeing bacteria or mold growing, taking that down, maybe discarding the seed that's out, putting out some fresh stuff and making sure you clean that feeder fairly regularly is really important.
And all sorts of guidelines online about cleaning bird feeders and how to do that properly. And also, I'm going to guess that you would add, if you have a neighbor who lets out his or her cats, don't put a bird feeder out, right?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Cats are the number one anthropogenic cause of bird mortality, killing billions of birds per year just in the U.S. So if you have a cat, please keep it indoors. Where I live in Windham, I have 3 cats that are living long, happy lives indoors, but I do not have bird feeders because our neighborhood has so many outdoor cats that I think it's just it would be bringing those birds to their doom.
Sherry, also a lot of Portland calls today. This is unusual. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am wondering about going back to the bluebird topic. I have some bluebirds in my yard, and I'm just wondering how they interact with the, I guess you'd say more endemic, because I guess they're becoming endemic, species here in Maine, the native species, as far as competition and territory goes, if someone could speak to that. Thank you.
Yeah, Adrian, I'll ask you, are bluebirds bad news?
No, not at all. And bluebirds are a native species that it's even in their common name, the eastern bluebird. And so that, the fact that they are expanding into Maine, that's just part of a natural process that's happening as our habitats and climate is supporting. So the main conflict that people see, there can be some overlap with, especially during the breeding season, between bluebirds and some other cavity nesting species like tree swallows. But again, that's something that we can help support by adding boxes and creating and supporting habitat that will, again, support all of those species from coexisting. The real conflict comes for bluebirds from the invasive non-native house sparrow. That's more of a concern. The expansion of bluebirds into Maine is kind of happening concurrently with all of the native species that occur here. So the competition that is occurring is not doing harm to, there's no indication there's, any species are being harmed.
There you go. Thanks, Sherry. We'll go to Sarah calling from Yarmouth. Sarah, we're tight on time. So if you can ask your question quickly, that'd be great.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about protections for nesting bald eagles. I noticed that when nests are found, there are a lot of people taking photographs of them and wanting to see them. And I'm just wondering, guidelines for protections and what we can do if we're noticing that.
Doug,
yeah, that's it.
Oh, Adrian, go ahead.
I was going to get into federal regulations and stuff. So, Doug, you can talk more about the specific guidelines.
I would say almost similar to what we were talking about before of, you know, encouraging folks to give them distance, especially if they're noticing that they're altering their behavior. As, you know, as Adrian would have said, if it is getting to a point of harassment, that's where I would say, like, getting in touch with Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife would be the ones that are most likely going to be the ones to be able to enforce any protections like that. But
and it seems to me we're almost out of time, but Doug, you know, there have been times I've come across bald eagle nests, and they have built them near homes and things, and so there are certain bald eagles who really don't seem very disturbed by humans.
Yeah, and I'll just say I think a lot of it is education, you know, even telling people like, hey, I think you're a little too close. A lot of people just don't realize the impact that they're having on a species. So start with educating.
Yeah, sorry we couldn't do a more complete question answer, Sarah, but we are out of time. Thank you both for joining us, Doug Hitchcox with Maine Audubon and Dr. Adrian Leppold, a wildlife biologist who's worked for years on the Maine Bird Atlas. Today's sound engineer, Jane Donahue. Our theme song composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And this is Maine Public Radio.